Welcome to More to Come, PW Comics World's weekly podcast of comics and graphic novel news, recorded this week back at the offices in New York City. I'm Heidi McDonald. I am the editor-in-chief of The Beat at comicsbeat.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at PW Comics World.
And I'm Kate Fitzsimmons. I'm the podcast producer, and you can find us online on Tumblr at PW Comics World on, yeah. at tumblr.com/PW Comics World.
I'm Meg Lemke. I'm Publishers Weekly's graphic novels reviews editor. I'm subbing for Calvin Reed. Happy to be here again. We're also on Facebook, I think, also PW Comics World.
Yeah, and don't forget, you could subscribe to us on many different popular podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple and so on and so forth. And you could also leave us a rating on any one of those platforms because we love to hear from our listeners. This week on More to Come, remembering Trina Robbins. Also, remembering Mark Bright. Webtoon contract issues, more turmoil at IDW, PW's summer reads, and the most banned books, and the briefs. Is Rob Liefeld writing something?
We'll see. Listeners, we are recording this at the PW Comics World. We are recording this at the PW offices in New York City. On a completely new computer for the first time in 7 years.
Oh my God,
years.
Kate, it's beautiful. I love that color.
If the audio quality has taken a dip, let us know. I need to adjust the settings then.
All right. Yes, please leave us a comment. Let us know. And, you know, we're about to start toggling hard time here. So everybody, let's go toggling. All right. Well, starting out with very sad news. Trina Robbins, the legendary cartoonist, activist, historian, as she put it, feminist, icon, really just she's a legend. She was an absolute legend, has passed away at age 85. Trina suffered a stroke about a month ago, and there were no social media updates on her condition. So, you know, I personally feared the worst, and the worst has happened. Trina has left us, but obviously she will live on in so many ways.
You knew her well, Heidi, right? You two worked at the Friends of Lulu.
Well, we were friends for 40 years. And, you know, Trina was a mentor to me, absolutely. I think I met her at my first Folk City Comic Con in 1985. And, you know, she took a shine to me. And her and her partner, Steve Waialoa, who I, you know, we send our love and condolences to Steve. There was never a more opposites attract couple that was more perfect together than Steve and Trina. You know, Trina was short and talked a mile a minute and just was as, you know, she was a spark. She was a fire. And, you know, Steve was this tall, quiet Hawaiian who, you know, just spoke, you know, at surprising intervals. And of course, when he spoke, it was always really great to listen to. He's an incredibly smart and fascinating guy. So, yeah, they were just an amazing couple together. And but yeah, Trina and I did lots of things together, and she influenced my thinking about things in so many ways. And she wrote two books of women cartoonists. Mm-hmm. The first one was with Kat Ironwood, and I think that one's pretty much out of print. And then the second one she did by herself. And these are just really important works because after she did all the underground stuff, it was really Trina's mission to make sure that these cartoonists weren't forgotten, and they were being forgotten. You know, mm-hmm. she had some trauma from sexism in her life that made her never want to, you know, let it slide mm-hmm. ever again. And boy, she didn't. And she did some amazing work because of it. So yeah, Trina and I co-founded Friends of Lulu, which was an organization for women in comics. It started, I think our first meeting was in 93. And we lasted quite a while. Trina was the newsletter editor for many years. And, you know, we did some good there. We made some mistakes, but we did some good. And like I said, well, you know, you never want, it's fun to be quoted in the New York Times, but not for an obituary. So I wish it hadn't happened. But, you know, my quote in there, which I gave to Vulture magazine, was that Trina didn't want to be the only woman in the room. Mm. You know, she wanted other women to be respected and admired and remembered.
And Fantagraphics published her memoir recently, her prose memoir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Last Girl Standing.
Last Girl Standing.
Did you guys have any experiences with Trina's work, or?
Well, I only had experiences with Trina's work as kind of an audience, right? Like, I never met her, never saw her, never knew her. I saw the impact that Friends of Lulu had on myself and other fans growing up. Just the knowledge it was out there, right? And I think I read her second book. The second history book.
And she did this whole book that brought up all these amazing women cartoonists that had been forgotten, you know, like Rose O'Neill and well, she wrote a whole book about them, and you think Nell Brinkley. That was another one. Nell was a huge influence on Trina. And, you know, Trina just saw this stuff as a kid growing up. I mean, these artists were very well known. It wasn't like she...
It's just one of those things that gets memory-holed because it doesn't fit the popular narrative. And so it helps to have other people remember and put out an alternate narrative.
Well, I would like to just ask some men why it is when they see a woman's name, they memory hole it. Because it's just so odd that it just seems they never remember women. Isn't that, it's just so weird.
Yeah, and then the funny thing is then they're like, look at me, I'm so feminist. I'm championing the first woman to do a thing a lot of other women have already done. I forgot about them all.
For hundreds of years. Yes.
And it's like, this woman doing it is awesome, and I'm glad she is. And also other women did it too. And you were there.
Yeah, exactly.
She was very active, you know, really up until right before she died. And I found that really incredible. You know, she was putting out new work. She worked really closely with Fantagraphics, which I also think is notable given their deep history and indie comics.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just want to point again, I know that she has many accomplishments, but since the one that crosses with Heidi here is Friends of Lulu, you know, it was really meaningful to me when I was entering the industry. To me, it was already an established organization, and there's a lot to just be said for that. Like, it had profound influence, I think, on young women
editors. Just knowing it was there.
I you know what, you guys, I had no idea you had known about Friends of Lulu in your formative years, so... you know, there's a lot of moments where I'm like a mic drop moment, and thank you both for saying that. And, you know, Trina would be incredibly gratified. But, you know, she knew. I have to say, I was always against, okay, boy, there's such a history to be written about this. And maybe if I ever find those emails that I printed out, it will be written. But there was a big schism between people who thought it should be men only. And Trina, of course, was the organization, or, you know, whether it should be men and women or women only. Trina, of course, was women only. And she really saw these other organizations. There was one called Sisters in Crime for Mystery Writers that she used as a role model. And just as a place for, you know, now we would call it a safe space. It wasn't called a safe space then. We had different names for it. But, you know, that's what she wanted. She wanted a place where women could just commune and, you know, connect and talk about things. And, you know, everybody brought... You know, everyone who founded Friends of Lulu brought a different aspect to it. And like Liz Scheller really wanted mentorship. And, you know, Trina also wanted the newsletter. She was like, there has to be a newsletter. I was like, well, then Trina, you do it.
And there were awards. That was
we did awards. I was the one
who
wanted the awards.
Okay, well, that's what meant a lot to me. Because in traditional publishing, you know, the premature of an award means a lot. And it meant to me something to see books winning.
Right. Because I... always wanted. Anyway, you know what? We're not here to talk about the history of Friends of Lulu. We're here to talk about Trina Robbins and her amazing contributions. I will say this in a really amazing coincidence. I might have mentioned here on the podcast that last spring, almost a year ago, I went to San Francisco to record an oral history with Trina. And it was done under the auspices of Capital Weekly and magazine with funding from the California Library Association, and it has just gone live.
Oh, lovely.
And it is literally like about an hour and a half of me talking to Trina one-on-one about her life from her beginnings to the most recent. And I will say Capital Weekly did an amazing job. They've put in photos. And so, you know, it's an oral history, but there is visual other than this, me talking to Trina for an hour and a half.
Where can we find it?
It is on, I'm going to have to find the link to it directly. But there is this, it's part of this whole oral
history. Let's add it to the
history.
Show notes.
Yes, we'll add it to the show notes. But let me see if I can find that. Meg, did you ever get to meet Trina?
I have met her. She must have come to the Book and Book Festival at some point. I've just met her at conferences. You know, mm-hmm. she really was around, you know?
She was so active.
She was so active.
Yeah.
And in the time since her death, you know, a lot of people have spoken about the relationship. And I was getting texts from cartoonists who I think of as sort of similarly iconic, frankly, who were saying how overwrought they felt about her death. And yeah. I think it's just been really interesting to see how many people she influenced.
She, by the way, it's at Capital Weekly, CAPITOLweekly.net, and then /oral histories, and you'll find it, and we will put it in the show notes. But look, you know, you guys just mentioned Friends of Lulu mm-hmm. as something that changed, you know, or gave you inspiration in, you know, when you're growing up in the aughts or the 90s. Trina had already made history in the 70s. Mm-hmm. She mm-hmm. co-edited the first all-women's comics anthology. You know, if people will say underground, I think it was probably women's, underground or no. You know, It Ain't Me, Babe. And then she did women's comics. She mm-hmm. was the co-editor of the co-op that put that out. And, you know, this, when I was researching this oral history, I just did this deep dive into the 70s in San Francisco and New York. And, you know, I'm kind of... Well, what do they call it now? Reality shifting. I definitely did a shift into that period, and just, you know, how protean it was, how important it was, and how these, you know, Trina was making history. She really was, and because she believed in it. And I'll tell you one thing. When Trina believed something, she never let go of it.
Right. She was fierce.
And important. Yes. Skill.
I always sort of understood not to tangle with her. I felt like that was just out there.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad that, you know, Meg only went to Comic-Con for the first time last year. And I think you left Sunday, right? Did you leave Sunday?
I did leave Sunday.
So because, you know, we have our Sunday night dinner mm-hmm. that Steve and Trina came to almost every year.
Oh,
although Trina stopped coming a little bit. But then, like, so this guy she didn't like stopped coming to the dinner. So Trina was coming back. So so it's too bad that you didn't get to come to one of our dinners. So, because that would have been, you know... You might have lost some of your terror. No. Okay.
I want to mention Women's Comics has a big, beautiful reissue edition that from Fantagraphics.
Oh, yes. That's right. And I forgot to make a backup recording. So I hope that worked. Okay. I'm making it now. Well, listen, it's been a pretty, you know, listen, rest in peace, Trina. Rest in power, Trina. Mm-hmm. You were such a beautiful... amazing shining star, as I said. And, you know, I was one of her proteges, but, you know, I dated a Jim Morrison impersonator. She dated Jim Morrison. Okay. So anyway, Trina Robbins, one of the all time great figures in comics history, for real. We also lost Mark Bright, also known as Mark Doc Bright. He was the original artist on Icon from Milestone Comics, mm-hmm. and he did other books like Green Lantern, Iron Man. I have a remembrance of him up on the beat. And I have to be honest, I wasn't that familiar with his work, but I kept seeing people paying tribute to him on social media, and the art was so stunning. I was like, wow, why is this guy not more famous? Because his work is absolutely beautiful. And just, you know, as my friend Jermaine put it, he just got comics. You know, he just knew how to make good comics. And I know that sounds like really simplistic, but...
But it's not. It's not. It's a whole... mindset.
Right, exactly.
You can be a great artist and not have that mindset.
Right, right. So he left comics, actually, and went to do storyboards for, like movies and commercials. So, you know, obviously he had a really great eye for action and all that. So, but he was really fondly remembered by a lot of people. And really an underrated artist who people should be, you know, he should be in more conversations. So rest in power, Mark Bright. Okay. Boy, where are we now? Well, good old Reddit, anonymous accounts striking this time against Webtoon's contract. So an anonymous Redditor posted some pretty fierce allegations about Webtoon's contract. Now, Webtoon is the platform for vertical scrolling comics, which are also called Webtoon. So they very sneakily, it's as if, you know, it was called Records and a company called itself Records. And so every time you said, I bought a record from, you know, Columbia, it would be, or, you know, Record, yeah, put out a record.
Their full name is Naver Webtoon, but they just go by Webtoon.
Yeah, well, it's like, I think it's actually Line Webtoon, isn't it? Like, they have the, because they are, their parent company's in Korea. So, anyway, the allegation is that their contract has gotten more and more onerous towards young cartoonists signing up for their originals. I mean, everyone can put their content up on Webtoon. It is a UGC platform, as they can with Tapas and other vertical scrolling comics platforms. However, with the originals program, you will get paid to do it. You will get some upfront money to develop the strip, and then you will share in revenue from various different ways that they have. And, you know, we've talked about Webtoon on this podcast many times, and the mysteries over how exactly they are funded. Mm-hmm. So, this contract, needless to say, raised a lot of questions because it claims that Webtoon can own 100% of your IP, that they take all the merchandising rights, that they take all the publishing rights, and other really, really bad things that no one should sign a contract.
Yeah, this is based on the person who claimed these things on Reddit, but we haven't seen the actual contract.
No. And right. I mean, look, it's not all that normal that we see contracts mm-hmm. from different publishers, mm-hmm. but, you know, the Beat is trying to get a hold of the contract. And, you know, listen, when there was a whole thing about Scout a few weeks ago, I had a contract in my inbox with the names in it and the amount of money they were paid in, like, you know, hours.
Yeah.
And this one, we're trying.
But you have been in talks behind the scenes with unnamed various creators, correct?
We have begun reaching out. And this, so the Beat put up an article, and I want to really shout out my contributors, Adam, or my collaborators, Adam Westcott, Justin Guerrero, and the great Dan Baiocchi, that we took 2 days to write a story about this. And I'm very proud in internet terms that we didn't just blast out a story very quickly. You know, we got
in depth.
We got Line Naver Webtoon spokesperson to actually respond to the allegations. They did put up a statement, which is kind of just like, you know, hey, this is industry standard and we are trying to collaborate with our creators. And, you know, listen, it's a little bit boilerplate, it's a little bit anodyne. Like I said, unless you see the contract, I'm not going to say who's right or who's wrong or who's good or who's bad or whatever the dichotomy you want to say. I will say the one thing or one of the things that the Webtoon spokesperson volunteered, and I did not know this, but the contract, so if you do sign up for an originals, the term of the contract does not end until 3 years after the strip, the last episode of the strip. So if I, you know, if you were to put up the last strip tomorrow, you would not get your rights back until 2027.
The digital rights. You can...
All the rights.
All
because
the rights.
If, yes. Because a lot of
including
the rights...
print.
Because it does have... Okay. They do have provisions where, yes, they get the publishing rights during this period. And yes, they get the merchandising rights during this period. Now, that doesn't mean you need to say, okay, you can get a lawyer, you can get an agent, you can negotiate, you can strike those out, and you probably should, because that is a really long time to sign away all of that stuff.
In situations like this, often they're just hoping you won't notice and won't say anything. It doesn't mean necessarily that they'll stick by these guns if you're like, hey, how about I not do this? Can I still do it without this clause? And sometimes they'll say yes.
Yeah.
Because clearly other, currently many...
Not all the creators signed this version.
Right. This is a new contract.
Mm.
Well,
I was going to say, clearly multiple Webtoon creators have had books published before the end of their series with other...
But yes, but a lot of them have been agented by Webtoon. Because that's the caveat, right? Like, they're not saying it can't go into print. They're saying, during this period, we'll be your representative to the different publishers.
And I think one of the things that's, you know, pretty salient here is this I don't know. Was Lore Olympus an original? I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. Or was it just something that Rachel Smith started running and it became a runaway hit and, you know, then she started making a lot of money from it. Smythe. I don't know. Smythe, yes. I don't know what the
Right, because there are a lot of things on there that are not officially quote-unquote originals.
Right.
They are on Webtoon, but they have not made this particular deal.
Correct.
The originals get paid some kind of ongoing stipend.
The originals, right. Yes, and they do a rev share because, I'm reading my own article because we put a lot of information in there. We purposely made sure that we put a lot of information in this. Okay. Offers payments that are generally greenlit and launched by the company. Offers several monetization options for creators, including ad revenue, paid content purchases when readers pay coins to get access to the latest chapters, super likes, a recently announced program that will allow readers to super like a series, kind of like a tip jar. So they have that in addition to the money that they would pay. I mean, they do pay for the publishing rights. They do share like, you know, with the merch, they share the revenue. It's a rev share model, but it's just the idea that you are signing away so much for so long.
And you can't really opt out once you sign.
Right. How do you define the last entry of a series?
It's when you put up.
Yeah, but like clearly people restart series. I mean, I think it's a little fuzzy. What is the last installment?
And I want to bring up a couple things. I mean, you know, Rachel Smythe, as you said, is the most, obviously the most influential creator on Webtoon and, you know, in print with her bestseller. But one of the other ones that was super popular was Let's Play by Mongi or, you know, Leanne Krushik, mm-hmm. as her real name is. And she left Webtoon. She pulled the strip off, and she is not. She wrote there. This was an incredibly difficult decision. No single event led to it. There have been ongoing difficulties for several years, most of which I can't discuss. And you know, she's doing a new strip for a different publisher. She is not doing Let's Play anymore. So
there are some responses even in your article from actual creators.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of ongoing. And look, I want to say I appreciate that Webtoon did reach out to us and that they did give us some information. You know, they didn't stonewall. Because I'll tell you, having written a lot of stories like this, it's very common for publishers to completely just ignore this kind of thing. But they did give us some information. That said, I would highly advise you get a lawyer to look at this contract before you sign it. I mean, not advise, like make sure you freaking get a lawyer because it sounds like there's a lot of things in there that need to be struck out.
Let's talk more about the Webtoon stuff because I was really interested to see the creator speaking about it. I mean, particularly the creator of Boyfriends, like there's some kind of out of the left field things that they were posting. They said, you know, did you know they stopped acknowledging me publicly around 1 to 2 years? Like, what is that about? Like, it definitely seems that this has brought up some bad feelings among a large group of creators. And I was really interested to see that, particularly because Boyfriends is published by Webtoon Unscrolled.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they...
Yeah, there's an ad for it running on the beats. A little embarrassing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're... From my experience, the publicity team's been really behind that book. Like, that's a book that they really pushed. You know, the reviewer really loved it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of times that author and publisher relationships fall down.
Yeah.
So this has been an opening for people to kind of get into a lot of the dirt. And I think it's also reflective of the generation and the kind of living one's life online culture of Webtoon's creators, right? Who are trying to crowdsource to some extent this legal advice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Heidi's position is really important because people don't know how to get a lawyer. Like, instead, they're going to Reddit. Right?
Yeah. Listen.
They need to go to how to get a lawyer.
Well, but also, I think people go to Reddit because they don't even know if it's illegal or not. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, people don't want to cough up money for a lawyer if it's not even a thing. They're like, is this a thing? Is this legal? Is this not legal? I don't know anything about publishing law. So, like, maybe step one is, like, is this a crime? Yes, no. And then, but after that, go to a lawyer.
They're book crimes. They're contracts. Yeah. Contracts and crimes are total, you know, they're agreements between two business parties.
But is this illegal contract behavior?
Unethical. I think the word everyone used was unethical.
No, we're not talking about unethical. We're talking about, can you get a lawyer on it?
Well, I mean, you can get your lawyer to read a contract.
Yeah, it's more like literary agent. Yeah. Agents and lawyers. That's a good question, because really they need literary agents, potentially. Sometimes they might need IP lawyers, but they don't have a book to sell yet, so they're not going to get a literary agent. It depends on kind of... It's an interesting question, actually, when I put out there to agents, because given the growth in Webtoon to book deals, at what point does an agent get involved? Because typically an agent is negotiating a book deal, but they may find themselves wanting to get involved at the earlier stage of negotiating a Webtoon contract to develop that relationship with the client, and ultimately what they're going to get their you know, revenue on is the book.
Well, I think overall this is a huge story because it's part of it's an important story that's part of a much bigger story, which is the rise of Webtoons in the United States, the rise of Webtoons outside of Asia, where they're already the preferred form of comics. We've talked about this many times on the podcast. And also, Naver is going to do a US IPO. So, of course, they're trying to build up a war chest of IP. I'll just say, as a longtime comics industry observer, I have seen a lot of companies do this, okay? They try to build up this war chest so they can say, we control 8,000 different properties.
But at least they're actually developing them, and they're actually real properties, as opposed to any number of IP farms stocking up dreck.
Yes. And look, some people have had a good experience with Webtoon, and yes, you do get a lot of exposure on this platform.
Apparently you can get a stipend of some kind, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's interesting because there is... Partly this is what I think has been asked for in some cases, which is like people would like to create content that is accessed for low cost, no cost by readers, but would like somehow to be paid for it, which if it's not like an NEA grant, how is that happening? And they're trying to create something like that model, but then it sounds like they're retrenching and trying to take more and more IP.
It sounds like as they get closer to their IPO, they want to have even more of a war chest of rights and not have to share it. And
Heidi is speculating, but yes.
Well, I am speculating, but, you know, the pieces seem to fit that puzzle. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say, you know, Meg, if you come in, you see a pizza and there's a triangular piece taken out of the pizza.
Then
you see a triangular piece of pizza across the room. It's fair to think that that piece came from the original pizza, but it might not have.
I want to mention, by the way, about the question of literary agents, because it's how I'm viewing this space, given that that's what my kind of work in book publishing has been about, like how an agent negotiates a deal. And BW is a book public, you know, we're about the book industry. I think that Kate McKean has a really great Substack. She's an agent who does a lot of explainers. And this, like, for example, in the article, there's a whole section about how they have the first option, essentially, to publish the book, right? And the question is, like, does that option allow the creator to refuse the terms, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, the details of an option clauses are really typical in book contracts.
Absolutely.
But the details of the clause vary significantly, and agents can tell you what is going to be in your favor. And there's even sometimes an argument that having an option clause versus striking it entirely can be in your favor, because then you have some definition of how long it's going to take a publisher to respond to your work, right? Yeah. You have, like, a shared understanding that they are going to look at your next book, or whatever, you know, these options are usually about your next book. In this case, it's essentially your next form of this work they've already collaborated with you on, right? Becoming a book.
You know, when you sign a contract with a publisher, hopefully you are signing a deal with a collaborator. You're signing a deal that involves, you know, it is in everybody's interest to make this project as successful as possible.
It is not shocking to me that they have a book publisher and they would like to try and obligate their creators on their platform, the digital platform, to go to the book publisher first for the first option. But how restrictive they make that clause is a big question mark to me, which I would love to find out when you get that contract. Because it's
Everybody wants this contract. Come on, kids, if you're listening, send us the contract. It's totally legal. Don't worry. You got to be the whistleblower. It's like Watergate. Oh, you're too young to know about that.
Listen, you're not the only person who has this contract. It's not going to blow your cover if you send
it. But it's not unusual for any publisher. Great publishers, many academic publishers, have very restrictive option clauses, and you just have to have a little chat with them, and then usually you can see.
But you should always have an out in a contract, too. Mm-hmm. There should be a term for the contract. There should be a time, you know, like that says
like 30 days to make a decision about whether you're going to publish as a book, and then importantly, the ability to refuse the offer they make.
Yes,
and then
absolutely.
Often there's additional clause where you... If somebody else makes an offer, they can match it and still take it. Like, you're obligated to go with them if they match the best offer. And that's something people would also like to usually cut.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of things like that in contracts. But sometimes there are whole different things in contracts when it comes to Webtoons. Mm-hmm. For example, Naver Webtoon.
Oh, my God.
Naver, the parent company, has now generously revised its rules, saying that now each of us artists can take breaks every 25 episodes if necessary.
Wow.
Previously, they were allowed to take a break once a year. Which, I mean, when you know how many episodes come out at a time, like every 25 episodes is much, much better than once a year. Because... you know, cartoonists have been complaining that they are overworked. You know, this could be also to try to scoop talent, because Cacao, the owner of Tapas, last year decided to allow two breaks every 40 episodes.
Now,
so they're trying to compete, I think.
Yeah, and they're very fierce rivals. And let me just throw this in here. If any, like there is a huge webtoon, generic webtoon industry in Korea. Now, it seems to me that if you have some kind of contract that says you can only take one break a year, that you are an employee, and you better be getting paid a bucket load of money to do this.
They are not.
So there is, I've heard, as I've been researching this, that there have been the equivalent of congressional hearings in Korea.
Good.
Where they talk about the working conditions for webtoon cartoonists. So this is a huge issue in Korea and in Asia, you know, with mangaka. You know, there was a story, I can't remember if we talked about it here on the podcast
or not.
Yeah, but, you know, about the early deaths of some of the greatest, you know, manga artists. So, you know, yeah, like, if you can't take a break from your own work, I don't think you own it.
Hmm.
So, red flag. I want to move on here. We have a couple of other things, but speaking of red flags and working conditions, there is we've talked about the Cartoonist Cooperative here a few times. This is a United States, well, North American based group of cartoonists organization that sprang up in the wake of the Comics Broke Me movement that came last year. So they did a survey, and I haven't really had a chance to really drill down in it, but they did a survey of just working conditions and rates that people were paid. And so on and so forth.
And it's illustrated.
Yes.
Got lots of nice infographics that are drawn.
Which is awesome.
I'm actually trying to figure out who drew them, which seems like
Like
I'm scrolling, you guys. Where's your own credit?
I know.
It's interesting. They have 100 respondents, which they call USEAN respondents. Mm-hmm. USEAN. Have you heard that before? That's interesting.
Yes. It's a very old term that's been around for a long time.
And it's very stupid.
Yes. Well,
there's a reason it didn't catch on.
Yeah.
Fetch did not happen.
They're bringing it back. 100 USEAN respondents working in mainstream publishing and self-publishing, I find that fascinating, right? Like, that is itself such a radical move to just put those together. Like, all comics creation is the same industry.
That they had advances and royalties. But I'll say from their survey data, again, only 100 people, but the USC and comics worker made an average of $21,000 through their comics work, with a median of $10,000 overall. So this means the takeaway, they did this in bold, so I'm just going to read aloud. The cartoonist, for the first year working on a long-form comic, the cartoonist will only see $15,000 of their advance. It may take up to a year or two more to see the rest of the advance. To put this in context, the 2023 poverty level in the U.S. was $14,580.
Yeah.
It's clear to see that the overwhelming majority of cartoonists need to be working on multiple projects or have other jobs to support their comic work. It is a grim report. It really is. Let's not gloss over it. However, they can take as many breaks as they like, as long as they have a partner who has a steady job. Or,
well,
they like peanut butter.
Alternately, if they're on an ongoing title from a publisher where they're bringing out a book a month, then maybe they can't take as many breaks as they like.
Well, a lot more to come on all of these topics. Obviously, the health, the safety, and the ability to make a living in the comics industry among creators is a topic of fantastic interest. Okay. Let's see. IDW. Oh, yeah. Can you believe there was more layoffs at IDW? I mean, they just laid off literally 40%. 2 out of 5.
Well, they lost a lot of their IP.
And they lost... Well, they didn't own the IP. They had no IP. They lost a lot of their licenses.
But that's what I mean. They lost a lot of their licensed IP because that was their bread and butter. And they did well by it. But, you know, they... People who own an IP's license have the right to move elsewhere. And unfortunately for IDW, they did.
Yeah. And I just think there's a lot of other stuff going on in IDW. Well, he was not laid off, but a legendary award-winning editor, Scott Dunbier, actually departed of his own free will. And he was the guy behind the artist editions, which are those giant oversized reprints of the art with all the detail in it that have been copied at every other publisher. Fantagraphics has done them. Dynamite has done them. I know other, I think Image has done them. So everybody's imitating them. So you'd assume that Scott will land on his feet. And he announced on Monday that he'd be doing his own publishing company. So maybe he could be a guest for something Meg and I were talking about before this podcast.
Oh, but, interesting.
Yeah. And then also, interestingly, the person who had been tagged to be the chief operating officer was also laid off. So that's interesting.
Right. And didn't she, when did she join?
She'd been there for a while.
But she'd been promoted last May.
Yes.
Sometimes this is a thing about the cycle of layoffs. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel for her. I don't know her personally. Mm-hmm. But this is a real issue with layoffs, I think, is that companies keep trying to correct. And then they reshuffle things. And then that doesn't quite work. And so they got a little taste of the layoff. And they do it again. You know, there's a lot of cycling in the tech industry like this currently.
Mm, yeah.
I think it's just a really hard period to be in, and hopefully it's going to settle down. I mean, in your article, you talk about the strength of certain properties like the TMNT, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, they got a tiger by the tail there.
I know.
The Last Ronin sold, we'll get to this in our next segment, an astonishing 148,000 copies in its second year. It wasn't even its debut. It came out in 22, and last year it sold.
Right. So they have some, there's some there
yeah.
at IDW. I feel like they have, and also I appreciate you brought up again Top Shelf's, you know, continuing strength in the book space.
Right. Well, you know.
Which comes up, I think, in the sales report that you were referencing.
Yeah. Guess what? Good books continue to sell, generally speaking, especially when they have some juice, you know, behind them. So there's actually another huge round of shuffles and people coming and going. Oni hired two people and promoted one. And Jim Viscardi, who was the head of comicbook.com, a pretty good website about comics, he left to go head up biz dev at Image Comics. That was a shocker. Everybody was talking about that. And then Ben Abernathy, who was the Batman editor at DC, has resurfaced at Skybound. So, yeah, people on the move. Wow. Well, people are on the move. Also, come summer, they'll be going on vacation. And
yes.
What does that mean for books, Meg?
So, you know, top of the charts at PW, everybody's reading our summer reads list. PW thrives on curated book lists, and I am delighted to get to pick 4 comics for summer reads, and then I get to pick a staff pick, which is not necessarily, doesn't have to be beachy. So I want to just talk a little bit about the summer reads list. It gets picked in sort of the dregs of winter into spring. So we're all thinking about what books really, what does it mean to be a summer read? Like, what does it mean to be a beach book? And we really try and pick titles. I try and pick titles that I think of as kind of quirky, like lighter in some respects, but not, you know, this comes up because, you know, you're trying to pick books that maybe you got a star review or close to it, or a positive review. I should say that first up, they have to have been reviewed. So actually the books on the comics list, you don't see the review yet, but they've all been reviewed. And this has to do with how late comics often run in reviews to their pub date due to how many reviews we get in the magazine, blah, blah, blah. But
due to people not always getting their books in as quickly as in other parts of the reading.
That can influence it too. In this case, all of these, I think, were submitted in a timely fashion.
Yay.
But these books all have been reviewed. They have official reviews. So I'm speaking sometimes from my own experience reading them or from the strength and like enthusiasm of our reviewers. But here's what I picked for our summer reads for adult. The Jellyfish by Boom, which is out from Pow Pow, and that's a Canadian publisher. And this is a translation from French. I love Boom, the cartoonist. Do you know?
No, Boom? I don't know that.
So they have this lovely webcomic, Boomeries, that I've been reading for a long time. It's in English. And this is a fictional graphic novel. It's just like a lovely, unusual, transportive little read. It's a romance, queer romance. And it has this conceit of a jellyfish floating in someone's eye. And it's, you know, a metaphor for many
Sounds
things.
Sounds very French, I have to be honest.
But it's got, like, it's very lovely and attractive art. And the reviewer really liked it. The review, actually, of this one, I think, is up now. And then the next book is Maple Terrace by Noah Van Sciver, which returns to the world of One Dirty Tree, but it's actually, I think, lighter and funny. It's got like a very gut punch humor to it. Have you read this yet, Heidi?
Yeah, I haven't read it yet, no.
So Maple Terrace, the series, already got, I think, an Ignatz? Maybe,
well, yes, that's true. He's been serializing it.
He's been serializing it. And this is out from Uncivilized. I really loved this. It's basically a graphic novella. I love Noah, and he really gets that cringe, the pathos and humor of being a human in the world, and particularly a child. This is from his like period in the child, and there's very lightly this like satirization of like 90s comic book speculation, like collecting culture.
Yeah, I got to read this for sure.
It's great. I thought it was great. Then Mothballs by, I believe, Sole Otero, which is translated from the Spanish by Andrea Rosenberg at Fantagraphics. This is based on the strength of our reviewer's take, which the review is not out yet. Mm-hmm. It's the English language debut of an audience winner at Angoulême, and it's an Argentinian cartoonist. And it's got a big sort of Almodovar structure, you know, like many secrets and relationships and women on the verge. It's a tumultuous history of her Italian-Argentinian grandmother who escaped Mussolini to set up the home that now Ro is inheriting on her death. So it's this big kind of transportive book for taking on your vacation. And then the last is a genre book, The Science of Ghosts by Lila Sturges and Elle Gehring. And Lila, I've been following for a while. She's a trans woman cartoonist. And this has a trans main character who's a forensic psychologist with paranormal visions. Basically, the ghosts come and tell her the last moments before their death. And there's a murder mystery. And it's got this kind of like throwback art style. It's just like a fun, smart, extra queer, transportive book. So like really like your genre beachy read, but smart. And I want to say for my staff pick, I picked The Puerto Rican War, a graphic history by, let me just pull it up, by Jean Vasquez Mejias, who, by the way, was featured at Mocha Fest recently. He's in the big Made in New York City exhibit that Bill Carlopas put up. I've loved Jean's work forever. Like, I used to go over at the Brooklyn Comics and Graphic Fest. I have, like, a kid's book he published, like, 10 years ago that I read to my kids all the time. And this is this incredible, every single page is a hand-carved woodblock print. Mm-hmm. And with
so
all the text.
So he literally makes woodblocks?
And prints with them.
Wow.
Mm. It's almost 100 pages of full woodblock carving prints as a comic with full panels and like intricate details. It's incredible.
That's remarkable. That's crazy.
Right. So
excuse me. That's remarkable.
It's remarkable. And you know, the originals are in a museum now. Like they're in them. So it's really just like something everyone should look at. It's an art object. So much more to say about it. The review for this is also coming out. You know, I've been reading it since it's thing Paping.
So Meg, I'm actually looking at the site right now, and yep. I know you do the staff picks, which was again the history of
the Puerto Rican War.
Puerto Rican
history.
War, yeah. So where are your other picks housed?
Okay, click on comics. I would say it's not really.
Oh,
user
I see.
Yeah,
the white them. The white type because against the blue background
it's
is
real.
Not as
in the print magazine. This makes sense.
Yes, mm-hmm. I see.
Think on the website, it's a real like. Adventure.
Yes,
also, if you click middle grade, you'll see the middle grade folks selected a couple comics.
And then you
about
could click
half
list.
The books.
And you could click list.
Find little pictures. Yes. They're hard to find.
So, you know,
one
we
of them is Bodega Cats.
We should save this for a future because we could be here all
yes.
day.
I won't go through all them,
this.
But middle grade and YA have books.
New Vera Brosgel. That's always
yeah,
a.
There's some
event.
Great comics.
Yes. You know, I was looking at this earlier, and there's a book called Bodega Cats.
Yeah,
so
I'm looking at right now.
Totally down with that. And, you know, this is not your fault, Meg. This is just PW style, library style, all style, where they say it's by the writer and illustrated by.
We don't do that in the adult comics.
So it's only kids, huh?
Kids do it because it's how they do it in picture books. But
yeah.
I believe you instituted co-creators listed as such, and I have and tried it in my
well,
in my
I
almost
noticed,
7 years tenure.
Yes, well,
but
good.
This is how
and
the kids
because
do it.
You know, one person can make a difference. Because I was literally looking up. I'll talk about it now. You know, our sales, the annual book scan analysis by Brian Hibbs is out, and I was fact checking, looking up a few things, and I looked up. As you mentioned, that Top Shelf's kind of nonfiction classics, March, mm-hmm. and They Called Us Enemy, continue to sell very well. And I was like, oh, it said They Called Us Enemy by George Takei. And I'm like, well, he didn't do it alone. What was the name of
Harmony
the artist?
Becker.
Harmony Becker. And so I looked it up, and I noticed all the listings say by George Takei and the
Harmony
other.
Harmony Becker.
No, not by... Oh, it doesn't say
oh,
that.
Oh, and the co-writer?
Yeah, the co-writer.
Yeah, sorry.
And then it says, illustrated by Harmony Becker. That's just so wrong.
But it comes from the picture book tradition. It's and that is published
yes.
as a white...
And guess
no,
what? Comics aren't picture books.
Right. Well, I'm glad we're talking about this. It's like a secret... No, and in the graphic novel previews, including the young adult and kids, I use the... And just co-created.
Yes, Meg.
Yes.
Yes. Because it's, and there was a lot of, there hasn't
so
been
far,
a lot of
I've
comment
managed
about this.
To get past.
That not having the artist on a comic as one of the authors of it is mm-hmm. really an injustice. But it is also the way how libraries do it. And you just see this misinformation. Repeated and
I mean,
repeated.
It's a metadata issue. It's a whole
yes,
thing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Well, but will there be more to come on that? But let's put a tickler on that because this is definitely something to
there
discuss.
Will be more to come.
There will be
moving
more to
on.
Come. Moving on. Also, we had banned books. The most banned books list came out.
Yeah, unshockingly, my co-babe's Genderqueer yet again is the top of the list. Though
third year in a row
and increasing number of bans. This is not going away. I just actually talked to Andrew Albanese, our colleague here at Publishers Weekly, who ran library coverage for many years and now is the news director. And, you know, he was just like, I was trying to say, like, should we try and think about some other topics in our upcoming graphic novel and libraries feature? And we're still settling on the topics, but he was like, no, we're not turning away from this. This is the topic.
So it's we're going
you know, we need to keep on it. And Maya Kobabes is not the only graphic novel high on the list.
Yeah.
It's just continuing. It's become this cultural phenomenon and scare mechanism.
Look, I want to say one of my very good friends who is a librarian, and I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to get him more attention, but he got picked on by the libs of TikTok.
Ugh, God.
Jerk. You know, sociopath. And he had to take his Twitter private. And, you know, this is just a great person. Who loves books and talks about books and, you know, being targeted by this hate group, which is what it is.
Well, it's not even a group. It's one person.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's TikTok is one person.
You're right. A hate person who can destroy people's lives with one little tweet. And you know what? That's not good. That is not good. I wanted to briefly, we might revisit this when Calvin is back. He might have something to say. But yes, I did. Brian Hibbs does his 28,000 word, 4,000, only 4,000 of which is him describing how he does it. Sales chart, a book scan analysis is just up on the beat. I did a few little takeaways from it, which I don't normally do, but I thought that might be good because I think people like to have bullet points. But, you know, Scholastic was nearly 40% of the book market for graphic novels last year. 40%. And that's with only 596 titles. Okay. That's an incredible
market share.
That's an incredible market share with real blockbusters. Obviously, they have Dave Pilkey. They have Raina. They have Amulet, the last book just came out. I know they did really, but they also have Five Nights at Freddy's, The Wings of Fire. They have The Babysitter's Club. They have these gigantic franchise books, and they sold just an insane amount of books. Mm. And, you know, Brian's pretty direct market centric, so as am I. But, you know, the huge success of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles The Last Ronin, which they just announced will be adapted into an R-rated movie. Hmm. So that's amazing. But I called this out in the article, and I want to call it out here. I was just amazed. You know, Brian goes down by publisher and talks about the sales. Now, we get the numbers from BookScan. We are not allowed to make a chart that shows the sales, but we are allowed to talk about them. So if you are very handy with Excel, you can probably recreate this, you know, jigsaw puzzle style. I was really amazed by some of the sales figures on books that weren't brand new. And just Swim Team,
right?
46,000 copies. Like,
that's
this,
great for
that's
Swim
amazing.
Team.
That's great. That's a real, like, these, like, Meg, I mean, you know, you were an editor at a, that's a good number, right?
Oh,
if
yeah.
You saw that
yeah.
on books.
For this, for year three of that book, that's great. Is this total? Is this total sales?
That's or? What was last year.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Right?
No, yeah. I love it. I love seeing it.
And now, you know,
especially for Swim Team, honestly, because it's a breakout. Middle grade, right?
Yeah.
Book from an artist who's previously an adult, you know, cartoonist in the adult mm-hmm. space, who's really like lovely, artistic. It's an artistic work.
And it's a book that everyone can relate to.
By a black cartoonist.
By a black cartoonist about how hard it is for black kids to learn how to swim. But I related to it because I never learned how to swim. So it's like, I
shortlisted for the NBA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it did have that.
It's a gorgeous book.
And NBA shortlisted books don't automatically sell another 20,000 copies.
No, they don't.
That is,
you know, I mean, I think right here, Jerry's book mm-hmm. led the way for a lot of people to recommend read-alikes, and Johnny's book was that.
Yeah.
Simply based on them representing real life experiences, mm-hmm. Whether from their life, like Jerry's, or from Johnny, a character, mm-hmm. I believe.
Well, just to give some other numbers, a New Kid sold 75,000 copies. That's really, really good. Now, it's controversial, and controversy sells, but it's and won the Newbery Award, but it's just a good book that people continue to buy.
It still continues to shock me that it counts as controversial.
Well, that's just, I know you don't like me to swear. That's messed up.
It is.
It is messed up. And then some other books that I just noticed that were mentioned, like El Defo by C.C. Bell, sold 25,000 copies.
It's got to be 10 years.
That book's been out for 10 years.
Yeah.
Now, they did do a TV show on Disney. Yeah. There's an adaptation of it on either.
Well, that'll do it.
That nobody pays any attention to, but nobody's heard of it.
Well, yeah, not if you're an adult. Yeah. Maybe kids do.
But I'm saying that's still a good number. And then this is the one that really amazed me, that T. Buies, The Best We Could Do from Abrams, which came out in 2017,
mm-hmm.
so 7 years ago. And this is a memoir about...
It's a beautiful book.
It's a beautiful, amazing, wonderful book about her immigrant family from Vietnam coming to America and, you know, their experiences. That sold nearly 10,000 copies, which, as Brian pointed out, that's more than any book published by Marvel Comics. And 10,000 copies, you know, again... If you were a publisher and you saw that one of your backlist titles sold 10,000 copies, you'd be excited, right, Matt?
Yeah, you'd be thrilled.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially literary memoir, it was her debut book.
Yeah.
It's a big... No, Tibui's book is hugely influential.
Yeah.
I think she can't do any more blurbs. She has something about that. She's like, if we didn't hang out in depth as friends before you wrote me this email, she's become hugely influential.
Just to put this in perspective, Monica... Now, granted, Monica came out towards the end of the year. And that
hasn't had that much time to sell yet.
And that's one of these things that this list is only the calendar year, so it doesn't take that into account. But Monica by Daniel Clowes, which was probably the most acclaimed book of the year, I know PW gave it as of, but it did come out in like September, October, had only sold 11,000 copies by the end of the year. So I just want to put these numbers, yes, and Meg is showing us her Monica
tote bag
which is really amazing, really, and Jack never sent me one of those, and it's really heartbreaking. So
I have a tote bag and you don't.
Yeah, she's got the tote bag and I don't. But listen, these are really, if you look at this, Brian's, there was 28,000 words, but there is a lot more. I've spent 5 minutes, 10 minutes, however long I've talked. There's so much of interest in this. I urge
you, Monica's
scroll
all the way down. It's a Monica's 10K.
What's that?
10,000 copies?
11,000.
I don't think that's bad. That sounds great. That's a difficult book to read. It's a really literary work.
Yeah, but
I understand it's a comic book, but it's also very, if you're comparing it to like a literary novel, 10,000 would be pretty good.
Yeah, but Daniel Clowes is probably the most acclaimed. You know, he's one of the five most famous cartoonists.
Yeah, but that doesn't always translate to sales.
Yeah, but I just want to say it was written up in the New York Times, the New Yorker. It got as much publicity as a book could possibly get.
It got 10,000 copies sold.
But we'll see how well its long tail does. You know, how does it do in 2024? How does it do in 2025?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to compare it to.
No, and I mean, it's good. It's good. It's a good number. I'm just saying I was shocked by that number for the last week or two. I was shocked by it.
Yeah,
it's
really good.
10,000 copies, almost 10,000 copies.
Book.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. And the fact that a beautiful book is still finding an audience is very heartwarming.
It is.
I think it has to do with librarians. It has to do with course adoption. This is where some of these books have gotten canonized, right? Like literally it means in the course list.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway...
Okay, and now the briefs. So, if you are not a fan of the redoubtable Ike Perlmutter, this podcast brings you some good news. Bob Iger has successfully held off Ike Perlmutter's shareholder coup on the Disney board. So, Disney will not be de-wokeified anytime soon, thank goodness. I mean, for a given value of wokeified. Also, in entertainment news, markets shift. The people who watch your movie may not be who you think.
Hmm.
So, the Boy and the Heron has finally come out in China. And China is now its biggest market. It has earned $73 million in its first 5 days and continues to earn at the box office there.
If they like Miyazaki in China, is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That, you know, for all, not everything is allowed to be put on the movie screen in China. If your animated film gets through, it appears to be a more and more promising market.
Mm.
And now, going old school for a moment, Heidi, I believe you promised this to our audience.
I did, and we have to deliver.
Rob Liefeld has decided to speak out, or rather, write out. And someone in this room did not know who he was or of his many and memorable contributions to the comics industry.
Well, how I envy that person, because they have so many wonderful jokes and also insightful comments to learn about.
He's a colorful character.
And his memoir, Robservations.
Yes. Well, you know, sometimes...
He's publishing a memoir, Robservations.
Yes. Well, Rob was one of the
The name of his podcast, which some people never heard
of. Well, listen, Rob is one of a kind. And, you know, he's developed into something of an elder spokesman. I mean, he's not that old, but he's developed into something of an elder Robservator, of Robserver, of the industry.
It's not so much his age as his, like there are artistic generations, right? So you can have two comic creators who are the exact same chronological age, but when they got into comics, one can in comics years be a whole generation older, because Liefeld got in quite young, very, very young, and is, for better and worse, and better, the most 90s human being who ever lived.
He is the 90s. He really is. Well, listen, I'll tell you this. I welcome Rob putting his version of history down on paper.
I'd be very curious to read it.
We need to get more histories of these periods. And, you know, as we mentioned at the top of the podcast, with the passing of Trina Robbins and the passing of Mark Bright, you know, people are no longer with us after a while. And
this guy isn't dying. He's writing a memoir.
Yeah.
Well, no, but what we mean is it's good that he's writing a memoir, because none of us are eternal.
Yeah. And I mean, he has a front row seat to a lot of history. So before we go, I do want to acknowledge that the passing of Ed Piskor, another cartoonist that we talked about many times on this podcast. And he passed away suddenly after some very serious allegations were leveled against him of harassment. And this has been a very tragic and traumatic experience for the comics community. And the community is trying to find ways to heal and to deal with that. And that community includes us. And that is what I have to say about that. And in all ways, there will be more
to
come.